Argument is Wen versus the people, and we are ready to hear from the petitioner.
May I please report? I'm Lisa Wise. My registration is 27553. I represent Jennifer Wend, and I'm appearing through the Office of Alternate Defense Counsel.
I wonder if you could raise that mic a little bit. It doesn't seem like you're there.
Ms. Weiss, if you could speak a little louder. Better.
Is that better?
Yes.
Around Christmas of 2002, Jennifer Wen shot Michael Adamson. It was a single shot to the chest and likely fatal within 2 minutes. Jennifer Wen claimed that she acted in self-defense, and the evidence showed that Mr. Adamson had a history of domestic violence against women. And in fact, a week before the shooting, Ms. Wen had called the police and allowed them to listen into an argument in which Mr. Adamson was threatening to shoot her with a gun. Everyone who knew Michael Adamson said that his behavior around the time of the shooting was very dark, it was abnormally so, and that his use of methamphetamine had increased significantly. The evidence showed that at the time of the shooting, he was very high. His methamphetamine level was 3 times the lethal dose. He also had amphetamines in his body that was within the lethal range, and also 30 plus times any therapeutic level. The coroner explained that this level of intoxicants in a person's body would have caused extreme aggression, great strength, paranoia, hallucinations, and no judgment.
Ms. White, yes. Can I ask you a question? Was there evidence of just what you said? Did an expert testify as to the impact of methamphetamine?
Yes, the coroner did. The coroner testified to all of these things that I just said and also indicated that in any other person, this would have been fatal, but that because Mr. Adamson had been using so much meth for so long, it was only for that reason that he was able to tolerate this level of chemicals in his body, and this prolonged use would have caused this combination of aggression and paranoia and other symptoms. Ms. Wen's story was that she was in her bedroom and she was backed up against a bedroom wall. Mr. Adamson was standing in her bedroom doorway. And at that position, he was threatening her with a gun, as he had a week before. When he was momentarily distracted by the dog, she used the opportunity to fire one shot to the chest. Mr. Adamson turned, walked into his room where he collapsed. And the place where he collapsed is the only place that the police found any blood in the house. And the coroner confirmed that Mr. Adamson would have been able to walk about 3 or 4 feet after having been shot without bleeding anywhere. And the firearms expert testified that the shot was fired from a distance greater than 4 feet, and the dimensions of Ms. Wen's bedroom were 10 by 10. So the firearms was consistent with the distance of the shot. The coroner's testimony was consistent with where the blood was found and with the measurements that the police took of the scene. So the physical evidence was consistent with the scenario that Ms. Wen described. The law recognizes self-defense as a natural right. It is based on the natural law of self-preservation. So if self-defense is a natural right, and if Ms. Wen's story matched the physical evidence, why then was she charged and convicted of murder?
Well, now she ended up here with a murder with provocation, right?
So right. She's currently sentenced on the F3.
So it's second degree murder.
Murder with the provocation mitigator, exactly.
Right. Which is far different from what the prosecution charged her with. She was on trial for first degree murder, right?
That's right, Judge.
With deliberation.
She was charged with first-degree murder after deliberation under the theory that she deliberately plotted this homicide in order to steal Mr. Adamson's belongings. However, the police searched all of her belongings very carefully and very thoroughly and found nothing belonging to Mr. Adamson.
Okay, so the jury acquits her.
Exactly, of first, convicts her of second, and then we went on appeal, and the Court of Appeals determined that the provocation instructions were flawed and gave the prosecutor the choice of remanding the case for a retrial or for an entry of a verdict on the F3.
Well, it would seem then based on the evidence in her defense that this was the right conviction. What do you say about that? This F3. with provocation.
Well, I think that goes right to the heart of the problem, which is that it's not for me to decide, it's for the jury to decide. And the jury should have had all of the correct instructions and the correct evidence before it to make that decision. You know, Ms. Nguyen has argued that she should have been instructed on reckless manslaughter, and Ms. Nguyen has maintained at all times that she acted in self-defense as well. There were people who knew Michael Adamson, and the police and the prosecutors in this case, who disbelieved the self-defense theory. They just personally didn't believe it. And this personal disbelief was communicated repeatedly to the jury throughout the trial. The prosecutors told the jury in opening and closing that Ms. Nguyen was a liar. During witness questioning, the prosecutor elicited evidence from the witnesses, opinions that Ms. Nguyen was a liar who was lying about her self-defense claim. And such opinions are inadmissible in Colorado, and it was improper for the prosecutor to introduce them. Just by way of illustration, in the Wilson case, which was decided 23 years ago by this court, the prosecutor, in closing argument, said at least 8 times that the defendant had lied. In my case, we have at least 15 times that the defendant had lied. And not just in closing, but also in opening and throughout the testimony, from 4 different witnesses were asked their opinion about whether...
Ms. Wise, may I interrupt one second?
Yes.
I wasn't sure about the facts in this case, but was I correct that defense counsel actually characterized some of the statements of the defendant as lies?
I think that's a good question. First of all, the defense only conceded one lie, not lies upon lies upon lies. And the defense only did so after the prosecutor started its opening statement. The very first thing that the jury heard in this case was the prosecutor's opening, that there was lie after lie after lie. So in that sense, it's very different from the cases where the defense might have invited it, which is certainly a factor in the prosecutorial misconduct analysis, as if it's been invited. That was not part of the defense theory. It was not something that the defense invited. It was introduced at the first instance by the prosecution within the first few seconds of its opening.
And could you just remind us what the defense counsel said, how the defense counsel characterized the statements?
I believe that the defense counsel said, yes, Jennifer Nguyen told a lie, but that doesn't mean that this jury should disbelieve. And I'm not exactly quoting, this is kind of a paraphrase, that the jury should disbelieve the other statements that Jennifer Nguyen made and that and pointed to the other facts that were supported by the evidence.
Well, now, after all, the situation is that she asked somebody else to take the body out, and it was concealed, right? I mean,
she does not have this person do it. That's actually incorrect.
Okay. Well,
she had no idea. It was actually true when she said, "I don't know where he is," because she did not know where the body was. She had no idea where it went. She did not call this person. She called this person, but she didn't ask him to come over. She called him, and he said, "I can tell that you're upset. I'm coming over." And he came over on his own volition, and then when he saw all the, because Mr. Adamson had put up all the surveillance equipment in the house, and when Randy saw all the surveillance equipment in the house, he realized that his presence in the home was going to be documented on the videotape, so he thought, well, I probably better move this body so I don't get framed for murder, and move all the surveillance equipment as well.
Well, my point is, she doesn't inform the police about this, you know.
That's right.
Supposed incident of self-defense. And so the prosecutor, what's wrong with the prosecutor saying, she's lying, take a look at, you know, the fact that, you know, the body remains there, and she doesn't report, and she has a friend remove the body. I mean, the prosecution can prove that, right? And did prove it, right?
Can prove that she did not call the police for inaction?
Yeah, it was part of the deliberation evidence, right? They were pursuing first-degree murder, and they were arguing that she intended to kill him.
Right. Okay.
So what's wrong with them pointing out that she wasn't truthful?
The prosecutor should and can point out discrepancies in the evidence. They cannot use the word lie, and they should not use the word untruthful. They should never give their personal opinion or implicate their personal opinion about a case.
Why is that?
Well, it's a longstanding rule based on the ABA standards and the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. It says the prosecutor should never express a personal opinion about the truth of any evidence, or an opinion as to the defendant's guilt or innocence. They can present the evidence to the jury, point out inconsistencies, and ask the jury to decide, and that's their role. And that's because the prosecutor has a heightened role, not just as an advocate, but also as as a person who's supposed to pursue justice, even-handedly, at the same time as being an advocate.
So do you think it would be all right if the prosecution said, one time witness said A and the next time witness said B, and both cannot be true?
Well, this is a case-by-case determination, and that's not what happened in this case.
I'm just asking you if that would be okay.
It depends on the context. I mean, in a context like mine, where the prosecutor is saying lie after lie, when the prosecutor uses that kind of language, then it becomes part of the problematic pattern. If it was used in isolation, I think the word true is very dangerous, and I think that it would be more proper and safer for a prosecutor to use language such as this is inconsistent, or decide for yourselves if this can be. But
can
I think the word true is dangerous.
Can be true, or which, I mean, it's almost a semantic problem, isn't it? I mean, I understand you don't see it quite that way. You see it that a prosecutor should never be able to express an opinion, but a prosecutor also should be allowed to argue his case.
That's right.
And if there are inconsistencies in the case, the prosecutor should be able to point them out.
They need to. That's their job.
So the problem is then what words are now are okay and what words are not okay? And
I think
anything that smacks of lie is, of course, not okay, but even truth is not okay?
I think that's dangerous territory under the ABA standards and the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. Now, whether something is misconduct under those rules might not necessarily arise and accumulate into a due process violation for appellate standards, right? So there's kind of like a continuum in terms of the repercussions. But the rules are pretty clear that the prosecutor cannot express a personal opinion. If it sounds like a personal opinion, then they can't do it. So these opinions are really powerful, particularly coming from governmental representatives. And it undercut the legitimate evidence instead of letting the jury decide. I was interested to see that both cases today involved testimonial videotape evidence. Because, and the safeguards that might need to accompany those videos in some circumstances, because juries value videotapes greatly. In my case, the prosecutor said it was perhaps the most important evidence in the case. The interrogation videotape of Jennifer Nguyen was perhaps the most important evidence in the case. And, you know, in the other case that was heard earlier this morning, it was about taking the video back to deliberations. And in my case, we have a very strange and unusual fact pattern of two witnesses almost testifying simultaneously, which is that Jennifer Nguyen was on her videotape telling her version of events, and periodically the prosecutor is stopping the tape to let Detective Graham, who's on the stand, interject his two cents and chime in, that's true, that's not true, that's true, that's not true. Mostly, that's not true, she's lying, that's a lie, that's a lie, she's been lying to me.
What was that technique of examination objected to?
There was no objection to Mr. Graham's testimony, and I have to say that this is not an interrogation technique that's being contested here. Okay, that's two different things. Because sometimes during the course of an interrogation, the detective will say, I think you're lying to me, to the subject, and that's right. Depicted on the tape. The detective making those words, that accusation. That happened here, but that's not even being contested here, okay? What's being contested here is that the detective is saying on the stand and giving sworn testimony that Jennifer Nguyen is lying. So that's very different to give sworn testimony that another individual, the defendant, whose credibility is at the heart of the case, is lying.
Well,
and this was happening at the same time, simultaneously.
Excuse me. Could you tell me how that even happened? Was the witness, the detective, called, placed on the stand, and then some question had to have been asked of him in order to get into the tape itself?
Exactly. Well,
what was that?
Sorry. The prosecutor was deliberately eliciting these questions throughout the tape. Like, now, is she telling the truth here, or is that a lie? So has she been lying to you, or is that a technique?
Well, you said that the prosecutor would stop the videotape,
right,
and then have the detective comment on it.
Exactly. So they would stop the tape, and then they would say, "Detective, what she just said right there, is that true or is that false?" Or they would say, did the evidence subsequently turn out to show something different? And they would say, yes, this is what the evidence said. So is what Ms. Nguyen's saying there true, or is it a lie? And they would say, it is a lie. And that's really, really different from any of the safeguards envisioned with videotapes. I mean, this is a lot of combinations of impropriety at the same time. Yes?
How did they get started with the videotape at all? I mean, how did it become admissible during the detective's testimony?
It was just an admission of a party opponent, and they, the detective used the foundation, was the foundation witness to introduce a videotape, and they said, we're now going to play the tape, and the detective, could you please stay on the stand, and we're going to ask you some questions, some explanatory questions. And, you know, that often happens when there's a videotape of a crime scene, right? They'll say, can you describe what we're looking at here? I mean, or pictures, right? They'll say, okay, this is when we enter into the house. And that's often a technique that's used for non-testimonial videotapes. But when it's testimonial videotapes, to interrupt it periodically to have another, you know, essentially a witness chiming in, is very dangerous to the jury's ability to perceive the video and make their own impressions without it being colored by the running commentary. I think of it as watching a football game. Do you watch it on mute or do you watch it with running commentary? I mean, it's two different things. I mean, whether you want it to or not, if you're listening to the commentary, you're sort of ingesting what the people are saying about the plays. So, and it colors your interpretation of it.
Counsel, there's, in my view, no question that that's at best very unusual way to present testimonial evidence in a videotape. And conceding your argument that it's a lot of power, I guess my question is, relate that directly to the issue before us, because as you've indicated, other issues that might arise as a result of that conduct are not part of this case at this time.
You're talking about repercussions in other cases?
I'm saying a lot of what may be wrong about that isn't before us.
Right.
So why are we talking about it? Directly relate it to the issue before us.
The issue before you is whether a prosecutor can deliberately elicit witness opinions about whether another, about the truth or falsity of evidence. And in this case, the prosecutor deliberately elicited an improper opinion from the detective that Jennifer Nguyen was telling the truth, that certain evidence was true or false. The witness is not allowed to say that certain evidence is true or false, nor was the prosecutor permitted to deliberately elicit those opinions.
But is there anything about the manner in which that was done?
How we view it here? The prosecutor used the word lie. I mean, you shouldn't use the word lie. I mean, they used the word truth, which may or may not be okay. It was very deliberate. It wasn't elicited in a more innocuous way by perhaps saying, was this inconsistent with what your investigation revealed? It was not presented in that way. It was presented in the way of, is this true? Is this false? Is this a lie? Is she lying? And so witnesses cannot offer those opinions, nor can prosecutors elicit those. It was done deliberately. That's one thing, right? It wasn't an accident that the witness volunteered. It was done deliberately. It was done as part of a pattern. The prosecutor here used some of the prohibited language that this court has acknowledged, not only in its recent cases, but also in Wilson, that the prosecutor should not ask to intrude upon the jury's credibility determinations. Does that answer your question? You still seem kind of puzzled.
No, I'm not puzzled. What I was thinking about is whether the manner in which it was done is more damaging and a more powerful expression of the prohibited belief expression.
I understand.
Personal belief, then it would be if the question were simply asked, do you think she was lying when you spoke to her?
Yes.
Whereas here, that seems to me that it's being done repeatedly and as the purported lie has just been told.
Well, it was really juxtaposing the power of the government on one hand and this kind of laughing, sarcastic, offhanded way that they referred to the defendant throughout this case. So here's the defendant telling her story, and she's not entitled to be heard straight through. You know, she's not entitled to be listened to. She's not worthy of attention. Here's the big government's opinion, like being interposed and coloring this. The fact that it was a governmental representative, the fact that It was a videotape that the prosecutor called some of the most important evidence in the case, right? So do you want your presentation of the most important evidence being interrupted continually by someone's opinion, let alone a witness from the government? Really, no. So it was the fact that it was the most important evidence. It was the fact that it was the defendant's story, which is the heart of the case. It was the fact that it was a governmental witness. And the fact that it was a testimonial videotape, all of that, I think, weighs toward why it was more prejudicial to do it in this setup as opposed to just asking the witness cold.
What difference does it really make in this case, though? Because the evidence seems to support this conviction that came out of this process.
Well, I think the self-defense case was extremely strong. There was only one shot fired. This is not a case where someone shot four times in the back. This is one shot to the chest. It's all supported by the physical evidence. Ms. Wine has a seventh grade education. There's no way she could have foreseen what these experts were going to conclude months and months down the road before the police were even called. How is it that her story exactly matches the physical evidence? I mean, the physical evidence supports her self-defense claim. The fact that she had not called the police and that there was inaction was very clearly explained in the evidence. It was because the house had tremendous amounts of methamphetamine in it. There was a factory of methamphetamine in that house. And had Ms. Nguyen called the police with also the presence of guns in the house, she would have been convicted as an F2 special offender. So, you know, she could do the F3 she's doing now, or if she called the police, she'd be doing the F2. You know, what are her choices?
So there's a self-defense instruction in the case that was given?
Yes, absolutely.
So they could have acquitted her of all charges?
Well, I did argue below that the self-defense instruction was flawed because she was only instructed on deadly force and not ordinary force, but this court did not grant cert on that issue. So, no, I don't agree that the self-defense instructions were correct, but that's not beyond the scope of cert here. Okay. The jury did receive self-defense instructions. And also the provocation instructions they received were flawed as well. I'm going to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, unless there's something else immediately.
Okay. You may.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464. Appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Basically, as you can see from the briefs, this case presents many, many issues, some of which are procedural, some of which are substantive. What I would like to do first is talk about one of the procedural issues in this case, which I think is very important, and then I would like to talk about one of the substantive issues in this case, which I think is the primary focus of the initial argument and the crux of this case. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions on any of the other specific issues. What I'd first like to talk about is the issue of whether or not the claims that were raised, not raised in the original direct appeal, but raised in the second direct appeal, were waived. Basically, the factual background for this issue is that the defendant appealed her conviction. The case was initially reversed based on erroneous provocation instructions. The people filed a petition for rehearing, asking the court to allow the prosecution the election of going back and having judgment enter on a class 3 felony, which would be the effect of proper provocation instructions and a proper provocation finding, or allow the prosecution to retry the case. The court agreed with that, modified the remedy, and remanded the case to allow the prosecution to make that election. After that rehearing was, or the opinion was modified, the defendant did file a rehearing challenging the remedy. Then she filed a petition for cert, raising several of the issues that she had raised in the direct appeal, as well as noting that a couple of the claims had not been resolved by the trial court because of the initial ruling that it would reverse. And so this court denied cert in that cert petition. Before the mandate issued, the defendant filed a motion to reconsider in the Court of Appeals, asking them to resolve the issues that had not been raised in the direct appeal because of the court's initial reversal. The court denied that motion, and then it was remanded for resentencing. The prosecution did elect to have judgment enter on the class 3 felony as opposed to retry the defendant. So the court amended the minimus, amended the judgment to reflect a class 3 felony second degree murder rather than a class 2 felony second degree murder. We're now on direct appeal of that resentencing. The defendant has raised now Of the 8 substantive claims she raises challenging prosecutorial misconduct, 6 of them were not mentioned at all in the original direct appeal. And I don't think there's any dispute that all of the facts necessary to resolve those claims or to raise those claims were available at the time of the original direct appeal. Now, there's several things I would like to point out.
I just want to be clear. You don't claim that the issue of prosecutorial misconduct was not before the court in the first appeal. Rather, you simply are indicating that not many of the particular examples and points of alleged prosecutorial misconduct were not specifically cited to the Court of Appeals.
The defendant did raise a prosecutorial misconduct claim in the direct appeal, and it was solely based on the testimony regarding Ms. Van Tassel and a comment the prosecutor made during closing argument regarding her selling drugs. Basically, these prosecutorial misconduct claims, kind of like ineffective assistance of counsel claims, can involve any numerous bodies of law. There's certain principles that a prosecutor must adhere to. There's certain things that they can and cannot do. These issues come up in the context of evidentiary presentation. They come up in the context of argument. They come up in many contexts, in preservation of evidence even before trial. And so these are all distinct substantive claims. So no, she did.
Was the claim concerning calling the defendant a liar and that expression of personal belief, was that part of the first appeal?
No, it was not even alluded to. Basically, the only claims that were alluded to or that were raised at all were the Van Tassel claim and the reference in closing to dealing drugs. All of the other claims, the claim regarding Randy Anderson, the claim regarding Ms. McNary, certainly all of the testimony relating to Detective Graham, all of the arguments, the challenges to the arguments using the word lie, never, no objection below, and not raised in the direct appeal. So these are new.
Ms. Hansen, before you go on, let me just clarify on that. So when this case came back to the Court of Appeals a second time, did the Court of Appeals rule on all of these issues that we have before us?
Yes, what happened was I made the same argument in the Court of Appeals that these issues that weren't raised in the original direct appeal were waived. I made the same argument below. The Court of Appeals did not agree with that and found that because they had vacated the conviction, this triggered her right to a new appeal. And that's one of my responses to that was not correct. I do recognize that I did not appeal that or cross-appeal that ruling of the Court of Appeals, but I do assert that it is properly before this court for actually 3 reasons. One is, under Rule 28, I'm required in my briefs to address the standard of review and preservation of claims. This clearly goes to the preservation of claims and standard of review. The issue of whether it's waived is an issue of whether it's properly before this court. Not only that, but the question that this court took cert on was not simply whether prosecutorial misconduct occurred, but it's whether prosecutorial misconduct requires reversal. And I think that fairly subsumes an argument that reversal is not going to be warranted in cases where the claims are not properly before the court, where the errors challenged are not properly before the court. And then finally, the other reason why I think I'm entitled to raise this argument in the court of, I mean, this court, despite not appealing the Court of Appeals ruling, is that as the prevailing party in the Court of Appeals, I'm allowed to defend the judgment of the Court of Appeals on any ground.
But assuming then that you are appropriately raising it before us, assuming that, you're nevertheless asking us to find that the Court of Appeals erred in addressing these issues. Is that right?
Correct. Yes, I do believe that their ruling on the procedural bar of waiver that I asserted in the Court of Appeals was incorrect. And the reasons I believe that is...
Before you go on to explain that, you are not also arguing, and I'm sorry about the awkward wording of this question, let me ask it differently. Are you arguing that this appeal is not appropriate after the remand, or just is your argument limited to what the scope of that review is?
She's entitled to direct appeal following the remand because she was resentenced. It's my position that under the waiver rules and the case law that deal with that, she's only entitled to raise issues in the second direct appeal relating to that resentencing, which she did not.
And I appreciate that. And this, my next question is a bit of a distraction, but I was sort of looking for your reaction to that process. If it is appropriate, it nonetheless seems to be oddly cumbersome appellate practice to send the matter back for a decision about which remedy, and then to commence a new appeal and then have to address what was not addressed the first time. I appreciate they didn't address it because they didn't think it had to be addressed if the new trial were selected, but nonetheless, it seems like a really duplicitous process, and I wonder whether you have any thoughts about the propriety of that, notwithstanding the fact that it's not part of your objection here.
Okay. I guess I'm not quite sure I understand, and let me know if my answer doesn't answer that. I do believe that there's a separate issue with relating to whether or not the trial or court of appeals should have addressed claims that were raised in the direct appeal that they chose not to raise because of the reversal. And so I think generally what the court of appeals does is if it decides to reverse and whether it changes its mind on rehearing or whether this court reverses it, generally before it goes back down to the trial court, those issues should be addressed. The issue here, and although I mentioned it in my brief that arguably those claims were forfeited because of the general nature of how she challenged in the rehearing and the cert, but the main claim here is that these are claims that were not raised at all either in the trial court or on the direct appeal. So I think under those circumstances, it's proper to apply the waiver rule, which has its basis in the idea of preventing piecemeal litigation, respecting the finality of decisions, protecting against, undermining confidence in the efficiency of the judicial system. If the defendant is going to go back only for correction of the minimus, resentencing something, and then he gets to raise or she gets to raise all the things that happened before. So there's good policy reasons why this court doesn't allow claims to be raised for the first time in a reply brief, in a rehearing, new claims. And so I think that under the circumstances presented by this case and the reasons for the waiver rule, I think perhaps the claims that she did raise should have been raised or should have been addressed because the Court of Appeals did not address them. The claims that she did not raise should not be considered now. Does that answer your question?
That's fine.
Okay.
What I was really asking about, as I mentioned, really was distracting you too much from your argument. Better that you continue with this.
Okay. Well, before you continue,
okay.
So just what's the result of your waiver argument? What if we agree with you that that there's been substantial waiver, what is left of the case?
Claims 2 and 8, as I characterize them in my brief, which is the objected to testimony from Ms. Van Tassel and the comment that the prosecutor made during closing argument regarding that the idea that she would be selling drugs had Mr. Anderson not come forward.
Thank you.
I would like to talk briefly about whether the defendant raises these issues in her reply brief, and I just would like to briefly mention she does argue that she's entitled to raise these new claims in this in the second direct appeal because Domingo Gomez and Liggett, these claims are based on Domingo Gomez and Liggett, which basically held that you can't ask the type of questions she's claiming the prosecutor asked or make the type of comments. And I would just like to point out the chronology of her briefing and the decision in these cases, including the Court of Appeals case in Liggett. These issues, these claims were well available at the time of the briefing in this case. Not only was there a recognition of these issues in the law prior to these cases from this court, but just the timing of when the briefing was done. Basically, these were claims that were available, and so I don't think they're new law. I don't think the case, I certainly think they apply on direct appeal had she raised the claim. I don't think there's an issue of retroactivity, but I do think that's a separate issue from whether you're entitled to raise claims this late in the appellate process.
Ms. Hansen, could I ask you to switch gears a little bit?
Sure.
Assuming that there's some, forgetting which specific for a minute, prosecutorial misconduct in this case, could you summarize the evidence from your perspective that would indicate, I think the Court of Appeals said that there's evidence that the defendant was the aggressor in this situation. I may be mischaracterizing this, but in other words, what is the evidence of second-degree murder that, from your perspective, that would cause us to look at whatever misconduct we find to be harmless?
Well, I believe there's evidence, there's no question that the defendant shot the victim in this case. And I think that certainly we don't have any information other than her statements as to exactly what occurred. I mean, the coroner's testimony, the physical evidence was not inconsistent with her theory, but it was also, it was completely consistent with the theory that the prosecution has, that she shot him deliberately. So the physical evidence in this case is not particularly compelling either way. I think what is most compelling in this case is her actions, both before the murder and after, and especially after. And I think that allowed the jury to make pretty substantial inferences that she did it deliberately and that it was not in self-defense. And what that evidence is, first off, and just briefly, and I realize some of this evidence could be used both ways. For example, the evidence that she had been previously, or the allegations that she had been previously threatened by the defendant with a gun. And then, on the one hand, that could indicate that she feared the defendant. On the other hand, that could demonstrate that she was in a situation where she was planning to kill him. She asked for a gun. She wanted to be there and ready to kill him when she chose to do so. We really don't know what happened. He could have gone in there and did what the defendant said and threatened her with a gun, or he could have gone in there and made advances towards her that were completely lawful, but she was tired of it and she shot him. So there was some indication that she had attempted to obtain a weapon prior to the shooting. But I think what is most compelling is what she did afterwards. And I think not only did she basically do everything she can to prevent people from finding out what had happened to this person, to the victim. I'm not saying she disposed of the body herself, but I do believe she requested the assistance of Mr. Anderson in doing so. I think certainly that's a reasonable inference from the record in terms of what their conduct was after the after Mr. Anderson came over. But not only that, she tried very hard to prevent anyone from coming into the house. She tried very hard to prevent anyone trying to find out what had happened to him, that he was even still alive. And then she perpetuated those efforts when people would come over to the house. When she was contacted by the police, she perpetuated those efforts to the police and telling them she didn't know what had happened to him. Not only did she deny knowing what happened to him, she affirmatively told the police, yeah, I think he went to Vegas. He texted me from Vegas. And so we don't just have situations where, you know, she just told the police, I don't know where he is. She took numerous efforts to hide what had happened in this case. And those efforts are very inconsistent with a theory that the defendant shot in self-defense. And so I think that is a lot of the evidence that the prosecution relied on. I think they also relied on evidence that the fact that the defendant used to sell drugs and was had expressed frustration or anger about the fact that the defendant or the decedent had taken some of her customers from her. I believe that was part of the theory of the prosecution and why she shot him, was that she was trying to take over his apparently fairly lucrative business in dealing drugs. And while that may not make sense to us, that was the world she lived in. That was the world they lived in. And so I think there was substantial evidence of her guilt. And I don't dispute that there was physical evidence that supported her self-defense theory. But I think there was also substantial evidence of her guilt. And in a situation where, and I'd like to next talk about the substantive issue of the prosecution's use of the word lie, because I think that's been the subject of litigation in this court in the last few years. It seems to be the primary issue urged, at least today, and in this case. Basically, in Domingo Gomez and in Kreider, this court has recently indicated that it's improper for the prosecution to use the word lie during closing argument when referencing witness testimony. Both Domingo Gomez and Kreider both dealt with references to witnesses' testimony, their trial testimony, and there were situations where essentially the prosecutor was looking at conflicts in the evidence and telling the jury, essentially reaching the inference based on those conflicts, that the defendant or the witness had lied, and then telling the jury that the defendant or the witness had lied. This case is much different. In this case, represents a very common and distinct reason why, if this court does address this issue, it should recognize that there are some circumstances where use of the word lie is not going to necessarily convey the personal opinion of the prosecutor, which was the main reason why using the word lie is improper. Here, the prosecutor used the word lie a few times in opening statements, and then several times during closing arguments. The prosecution used the word lie in opening statements in clear reference to the defendant's statements to the police, where she undisputedly lied numerous times. Again, not just about what happened during the shooting, and in fact, at that point, the first statement, there was no indication that there was even a shooting that occurred. But basically, the prosecutor said, you will hear lies and lies and lies. So the prosecutor at no point ever called her a liar, just said, you will hear lies. I'd like to quote a couple of the comments from the record.
Before you go on, okay. What's the distinction you are making? It wasn't testimony or that?
There's two distinctions. Okay. One is that it wasn't trial testimony, it was actual evidence in the record. And the other thing is the opinion.
Excuse me, I mean, any kind of evidence is testimony. So what? I don't understand that distinction.
Well, it was not something that you had to reach an inference to decide who lied. If a witness had testified, I lied, I think that would be proper comment. We don't have that issue before us. I'm saying it's different because here we're dealing with actual evidence in the record that the witness lied. And I guess the difference, I do understand, it can come in the form of other evidence, pretrial statements, statements made to other people, but it can also come in the form of witness testimony. If the witness gets up on the stand and says, I lied, the prosecution doesn't have to reach any inferences and express their personal opinion on whether or not that person lied. They said, I lied. So that would be a proper comment too, although we don't have that here. What we have is evidence that's outside of the record, specifically including lies. And what's, I think, most important, though, what distinguishes this from Domingo Gomez and Kreider is the fact that the defendant lied was completely undisputed. And I think it's important to look first up in the context. The prosecutor didn't say she lied about everything. The prosecutor said she lied to the police. And I would like to point out numerous things that were quoted at numerous quotations. She does lie to people about what happened. She lies. Yes, Jennifer Wind lied. She lied to a number of people. She lied about what happened. And Jennifer Wind told a lie. She told that lie, and then she had to keep going with it. She didn't lie because she didn't act in self-defense. She lied because she figured what happened. Ladies and gentlemen, she lied. These are all quotations from defense counsel during opening statements and closing arguments. And I'm not trying to say that it was okay for the prosecutor to use the word lie because defense counsel did. I'm saying it's okay for the prosecutor to use the word lie in this case because that was exactly what the evidence was, and it was undisputed that she lied to the police. So,
well, I guess I'm a little confused. She didn't testify at trial, right?
No.
And her statements came in by version of a videotaped interrogation that the police had done?
Yes.
Is that right? Anything else?
No. I'm sorry. There was statements. She did make statements to other people about what had happened, and they testified about what she told them.
I'm confused as to what you're telling us, that there's no dispute that she lied. And I don't know what you're saying.
She
just lied about certain things, lied about everything.
She lied about certain things. She lied about where, what had happened that night, that she claimed she told police and she told friends or these other people that they had gotten in an argument and that the victim had just left. She claimed that she didn't know where he was, that she knew that he was still alive. She claimed that he had gone to Vegas and had texted her from Vegas and told her to move out. So the prosecution's, there's no dispute that these were lies.
And do you think that makes it okay for the prosecution to characterize it as a lie?
Yes.
As opposed to saying it's up to you, the jurors, who must determine what happened here. And here is the evidence that we have. Here's the evidence put on in the words, through the words of the defendant? You make up your mind?
Yes, I do believe in the circumstances of this case where she told lies and we don't have a situation where it's just an inference based on comparisons that she lied. She admits that she lied. She admits to the police officer she lied. Her defense attorney admits throughout the trial that she lied. It's completely undisputed that she lied. And I agree it would be a problem if the prosecutor said something like, everything she said was a lie.
Well,
but they never said that.
Isn't that what it sounds like when the prosecutor says, you will hear lies and lies and lies and lies? He doesn't say except.
No, the prosecutor, though, often in most of their comments anchored those to actual statements that she made, such as, I don't know where Mike is. I'm sure Mike is fine. Mike went to Vegas. Mike texted me. Those kind of comments, the prosecutor throughout the closing argument often referenced those statements. If you look at the...
Counsel, if there is no contest what the prosecutor is talking about, then why was he doing it? Why the repeated references to lies, 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 unless the point is that she's also lying about self-defense?
Well, I think because in this case, this case is basically saturated with deception. The defendant's conduct after the shooting was one act of trying to keep things quiet and keep things secret and prevent people from learning what had happened to this person. And so I think we have
the point is, and so you shouldn't believe her now about self-defense.
But she's not saying any, the prosecutor didn't say you shouldn't believe her now. The prosecutor said she lied. She lied to the police. She lied to her friends. That was all the prosecutor said. And that statement, she lied at that point. It was true. It wasn't an inference. It was, she admits she lied at that point. And so it's not, they're not asking he's not asking the jury to say, you know, she lied to you today or anything like that, which is what we had in Domingo Comas and Crider. We had prosecutors' comments were specific. She lied. And she did. And she admits she did. And it was evidence in the record, and it was undisputed. And I think under these circumstances, especially considering most of the prosecutor's comments during closing argument were specifically linked to her actual lies to the police and to friends, I think under these circumstances, you invoke not the issue of whether the use of the word lie expresses the personal opinion of the prosecutor, you invoke the proposition that prosecutor is entitled to refer to evidence in the record. We don't even need the proposition that you can create reasonable inferences from evidence in the record.
I'm confused because I thought the sense of the rule was that it's not for the prosecutor to make the judgment.
Right.
It sounds like consistently the prosecutor is making the judgment, particularly with this interrogation and, you know, technique, really, when you stop the videotape and then you ask the police, now, what is your judgment? Did she lie or not?
Well,
so there's a judgment, the prosecutor's judgment, on the judgment of the police, both standing in the shoes of the state, crossing the line. I mean, right?
I don't think any of the prosecutor's comments during opening or closing statement at all expressed the prosecutor's judgment that she was lying. Other than to reference the fact that she did lie to the police. This is not a judgment, or this is not creating an inference or expressing a personal opinion, I think she lied. This is saying she lied. Or it's the same thing as saying she said it was Tuesday. He's stating a fact that was she did. And there's no dispute. There's absolutely no dispute. And I think also if you look at the statements regarding Detective Graham, if you really look at a lot of these questions, the prosecutor never said, was she lying there? There's a lot of questions that reference, what did you say to her? And that elicited the testimony, well, I told her I didn't think she was being truthful with me. Well, why did you do that? So a lot of that stuff, I don't think almost any, if any, I looked through any of the comments or the actual questions to Detective Graham said, did you think she was lying? The comments, the questions about the Walmart thing and the picture thing where the detective ultimately said, I found out this information was inconsistent with what she told me, and so that she was clearly lying, something like that. These were not elicited by the prosecutor. The prosecutor said, when did Walmart close on Christmas Eve? It was the witness who went on to make the comment, and so she lied. So I think with the detective, Graham, you need to really look at the questions that they were asked, especially since what we're dealing with here is not the admissibility of evidence necessarily, but the prosecutor's misconduct or lack thereof. And so I think to characterize the questions by the prosecutor, Detective Graham, as asking whether or not the defendant lied to him is actually not an accurate characterization of the record.
Ms. Hansen, let me just follow up 1 second on that, and I'll let you conclude. But several times when you've been addressing us, you've said it was a fact that she lied. They were simply pointing out the fact that she lied. How do we know that? How did they know that? How did the officer know that? How did the prosecutor know it? Was it a question of admission before trial that she conceded she was lying? Were they simply saying she said two things that were inconsistent and therefore we know she must have been lying one time or the other? What is the fact? How do we know that she lied?
Because she acknowledged in her statements that what she had said before wasn't true.
Okay, and that's before trial, and you're saying that occurred before the prosecutor ever referred to her as lying.
Yes. I mean, I think it's clear from looking at the whole, I mean, I think that's not only evident from inferences. I mean, you can't have a situation where he's in Vegas texting her and I shot him 2 days before that. I mean, obviously that creates a situation where one of those are lies. But she acknowledged there was a lot of conversation between these two during the interrogations, and she acknowledged throughout the second interview that she had, because she had really insisted during the first and the first interview and the first half of the second that she was telling the truth. She actually raised the issue during the interviews about how truthful she was being and how honest she was being, and I think she acknowledged during the second that she had not been truthful.
So she said something in the second interview or subsequent interviews like, oh, okay, when I said that other thing in the first interview, I was lying.
I don't know that she said it that directly, but I do believe her comments in the second interview acknowledged that she had not been telling the truth about all of these details. And I think, too, it's important, too, that there's no, the fact that everybody at trial recognized that she had lied to the police, the fact that defense counsel never objected to any of these comments, the fact that defense counsel used the word lie himself numerous times just shows this was not something that was a problem in this case because it was a well-established fact. The question is, you know, how do we interpret the fact that she lied? Does that mean she was scared because she had killed him, but she was worried about the drug in self-defense, but worried about the drugs? Or does it mean that, so basically the interpretation of why she lied was still left up to the jury, but the fact that she lied was well-established and was simply commented on. Unless this court has any further questions, we would ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Is there anything in particular you want me to start with?
Well, I'd like you to address the procedure point, why there wasn't a waiver on the...
Okay, well, first of all, the prosecution did not appeal the Court of Appeals ruling on that procedural argument, so it's just not even properly before this court. They didn't file a petition for cert, they didn't cross appeal, so it's not before the court.
If you're going to start with that, perhaps you should address her argument that it is before the court because she's required to address it, and in essence, because it always is, that's preliminary.
Okay, to start with Justice Bender's question, you asked whether the Court of Appeals resolved all of the issues in this immediately below in the second appeal, and the answer to that is no. The Court of Appeals has never addressed the detective's testimony. The Court of Appeals has not addressed the misconduct regarding the police report being bandied about. Those two issues, the misconduct as to the police report and the detective's testimony, which is very important, has never been addressed by the Court of Appeals. So no, if this case for some reason doesn't reach those issues, then it should be remanded to the Court of Appeals for a resolution of those issues. And then Justice Martinez, you asked the question, was any prosecutorial misconduct raised in this first appeal? And the Attorney General replied that only the Van Tassel opinion was raised. The Van Tassel opinion the Van Tassel issue does concern improper personal opinion. Debbie Van Tassel testified, I did not believe the defendant's story that Mike had threatened her. So, and it was argued during the first appeal that it was misconduct for the prosecutor to elicit that testimony and that expression of personal belief. So yes, personal belief was an issue in the first appeal. Those claims were expanded in the second appeal, in part because Domingo Gomez and Liggett are new. Liggett decided as a question of first impression that these were they lying questions are improper. That was a question of first impression in Liggett that was brand new law. And Domingo Gomez characterized the word lie as a flash word that was so striking that it was necessarily improper. And that was new language. In Wilson, the word lie was considered improper and arising to a due process violation when it was done repeatedly in the context. And I think all of that is still true. But Domingo Gomez was the first case to really characterize that as a different type of word. The other thing I should mention is that Wilson was 23 years ago, so, and the Court of Appeals had substantially watered it down in its interpretations, particularly in the Dashner and the Kerber cases, which said that in some circumstances it's okay for a prosecutor to say the word lie. So when Domingo Gomez and Liggett came out with their strong language and their brighter rules, the legal landscape definitely changed, and it would have been derelict in my duty had I not added those issues to expand the prosecutorial misconduct claim. Justice Hobbs, you asked, are there any other questions about the procedural issue? Okay, Justice Hobbs, you had asked why didn't she call the police after the shooting? Well, for one thing, Mr. Adamson was dead within 2 minutes, so there's nothing that anyone could have done. The second is that Ms. Nguyen mistrusted the local police because she had been a vocal advocate in this shooting of a good friend of hers. The police had shot a good friend of hers, and she had been very outspoken about it. And the police have been following her around town because of this, and she's been putting up flyers. So there's this long history of her mistrusting the police. And to note, she did call the police a week before when she really needed help and was being threatened, but she said, no, don't come to the house. And the reason why, she explained in her video, is because there were methamphetamine precursors and a factory in the house. And like I said before, she would have faced more time for the drugs than she is currently serving right now for the homicide. Okay, I think Justice Malarkey really hit the nail on the head when she said, well, what did she lie about? Because the Attorney General and I differ so much on what these lies pertain to. There are allegations that she lied on kind of peripheral, smaller facts that just generally portrayed her as a total liar, a perpetual liar. And there were direct accusations, very, very direct, that she lied about the self-defense claim. For example, Detective Graham testified that Jennifer Nguyen lied about why she shot Mike Adamson. He said, I asked her why she fired the shot, and again, I got lies. Debbie Van Tassel testified that she disbelieved Mike's claim that, Jenny's claim that Mike threatened her with a gun. So in some ways, these witnesses testified very, very directly to the self-defense claim.
Well, you know, he's in Vegas, and she knows for sure he's dead.
I'm sorry?
He's in Vegas, she says.
I cannot even tell you that is a lie, because that is not my place. That is the jury's place. I mean, I can tell you whether that was contested or not, and I can tell you that the defense did not concede any lies except for the fact that she shot him. And I can also tell you that in closing argument, the prosecutor said the only thing she gave up is that she shot him. And by making that statement, the prosecutor was basically telling the jury everything else she said was a lie. And then they would say, she lied about Walmart, she lied about pictures. Is this another lie too? Is that another lie too? I mean, they cannot use this language.
Could I ask just to follow up on that? So did she ever concede to the police that she lied, or did she just
tell different accounts? Here's how it happened. Okay, she makes the initial statement herself. She makes her initial statement where she says, you know, he threatened me. He has a history of domestic violence. He's violent. He was spying on me. He pointed a gun at me. He choked me. Then he left. Okay, so, and then the prosecutor, the police officer keeps pushing her, saying, please tell me what happened. Please tell me what happened. And she says, okay, I lied. I shot him. Is that what you want to hear? I shot him. That's how it happens. Okay, so she never concedes, I lied about Walmart, I lied about pictures, I lied about him being violent, I lied about him having domestic violence. I lied about him choking me. I lied about him pointing a gun at me. I lied about the dog. I lied about us being in the room. None of that was conceded. The only thing conceded is I lied, I shot him. Okay, is that what you want to hear? That was her language. The physical evidence could not go both ways. She was in her bedroom. She was in her bedroom when the shot was fired. I mean, what does that tell you? There are two guns. It was Mr. Adamson who bought these two guns. He gave one to Ms. Nguyen, kept one for himself, and was telling all the neighbors, boy, I hope she shoots herself. The evidence of post-crime conduct might be really important if this was maybe an ID case and you didn't know who fired the shot. You know, if somebody says, I didn't do it, but I ran, I mean, that really tells you something right there. Like, that's weird. But if someone doesn't plan the shooting and it just kind of happens, I mean, the fact that they completely fall apart afterwards is not necessarily indicative of guilt. It just shows that this was just not planned. And self-defense looks to what the defendant was perceiving at the moment of the shooting. It doesn't look to what happens after. It looks to what was happening at the moment of the shooting. And at the time of the shooting, Mr. Adamson was high on methamphetamine. He'd been threatening her, and they were in her room, and we know these things. There is no evidence that Ms. Nguyen asked Randy to help. The only evidence is the Randy's categorical denial that Ms. Nguyen never asked him for any help. That was the only evidence. I don't think there's any reasonable inference to the contrary. When the Attorney General says there's no dispute on these facts, I disagree. I think you just have to kind of look at it for yourselves. Credibility was key in this case, and the misconduct made all the difference. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.